Next up, Larry Seams from the ACLU discusses Torture Awareness Month. So I want to welcome to the show Larry Seams. How are you today?
Thanks very much. I'm good. Thanks. How are you?
Good. You're joining us from Frankfurt.
I am.
What you doing out in Frankfurt?
Some series of meetings for a network of cities of asylum for writers who are in forced to seek refuge overseas.
Really? Do you have a moment to tell us about that? I want to talk about the torture report and others, but that's very important news.
Sure. I actually, my full-time day job, in addition to the with the ACLU on the torture report, is I work for Pen American Center. I do the freedom to write work, the free expression protection work for Pen, and so we do a lot of work to protect writers who are facing persecution overseas, and that includes, of course, arbitrary detention and torture. Pen is an international organization of writers, and we have affiliates all around the world. And many of our affiliates in Europe are working with this really cool project where a number of cities in Europe offer a place of refuge, sort of a fellowship and a place to live for writers who are forced to flee persecution in their home countries.
And do we have some countries we can list that this would draw up?
Yeah, right now in the cities, there's a network of, I think, 31 cities in Europe and a couple in North America, and there are writers from everywhere from Zimbabwe to China to Iran to Iraq, Syria, let's see, Kenya, and on and on. Actually,
are there any countries that surprise us, or that might? Well, maybe they shouldn't surprise us if we're paying attention, but might surprise us.
There are countries that 20 years ago you wouldn't think would be sending writers into exile, but that now are, and that includes places like Kenya, in Africa, and some of the Eastern European countries that you had hoped, were going to move to democracy. Yeah,
right. It changes a lot of things over time. So let's talk a little bit about Torture Awareness Month and the torture report that's out. So first off, what's Torture Awareness Month?
Well, it grows up around the June 26th, which is the UN designated day in solidarity with victims of torture, which was established on June 26th to commemorate when the convention torture took effect. And so, out of that has grown an entire month, I'm sorry to say. It's sort of sad that we need this, but a month in which, we're asked to remember victims of torture around the world.
And what type of events do we expect to have happen during that time?
Well, I think, some organizations are doing, actual public events. Penn and the ACLU have worked together over the past year to do a number of public events that include readings from the torture documents. At the torture report, what we're doing is we're marking the month by, looking at through this 130,000 page pile of documents that the ACLU has won the release of from the federal government. And just posting one of those documents every day on thetorturereport.org, which is a very short, sort of summary of what the document is and some interesting links from that document to further information. I mean, the idea is quite simple. It's, I've been doing this project with the ACLU now for about 7 months. And, in a sense, what this document a day thing is meant to do is to, invite everybody to do essentially what I've been doing for 7 months, which is just, go through these documents, pick them up, look at them, read them, and really decide for yourself about, what you feel or how you would answer the question of whether the United States tortured people and how we feel about that as a country and whether we should do something to atone for that and to correct that.
Well, George Bush is supposedly quoted as having just mentioned about 24 hours ago, a little over 24 hours ago, that we waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Now, to me, this was not news. In fact, basically my first instinct was to tell a few people who were rather excited about that. I thought he already said that. I thought this was old news. Is this news? Guess it is news. Maybe he hasn't specifically said that like Dick Cheney did. But, we do have people now at the highest form of the United States government who have admitted to not only that the United States tortured, but that they were a part of it. And it seems to me like any accountability is in slow motion.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think, you know, I think the admissions that we have are, you know, are incomplete admissions. I mean, you know, the former vice president has admitted we'd waterboarded, you know, three people as a number of former Bush administration.
But more importantly, he said he signed off on it.
Absolutely, but again, you know, what they will always say is that they, in fact, that the treatment that we, that, you know, the enhanced interrogation techniques that we were using were in fact deemed legal and are therefore not torture. And so they continue to play that kind of semantic game, and, you know, and to try to obscure the whole, you know, to continue to obscure the facts around what exactly we did and what the impact was. I mean, when Dick Cheney, keep in mind, when he mentions that we waterboarded people, he's bragging. He's, you know, he's still, he and Mark Thiessen and a number of others are out there still insisting that this stuff worked, that we got valuable intelligence. Of course, the record shows not only that, you know, there's no question that the treatment that they insist was legal and, you know, did not reach the definition of torture was undoubtedly torture by any definition, and also, furthermore, that it didn't produce the kind of intelligence that they talked about, and that there's no indication that any information we got using those abusive methods could not have been gotten any other way.
And what about a foreign action that's happening now? I know, for instance, lawyer Scott Horton was one of many people involved in a Germany case against Rumsfeld. We've had Italy convict in absentia a little over a dozen CIA agents. And we have the Baltazar Garzón drama. In fact, now an internal drama for his
yeah,
actions.
Yeah, yeah.
But
absolutely.
So these actions, I would say, you know, at least promote things. And then we have the UK basically saying, well, we kind of need to reevaluate our relationship with the United States so that we don't be seen as, they didn't use this word, this is mine, poodles.
Yeah, actually, but it's actually interesting. You know, I mean, there is, you know, we talk now, and I think one of the more hopeful and exciting, you know, parts of the struggle for accountability here is what we'd call transnational justice, you know. I mean, you cite a number of cases, you know, where foreign courts have now, you know, sort of pressed the United States. What's interesting is, you know, there's several cases that are in the UK and Australia, cases that involve, say, former Guantanamo detainees who have been released and returned home. In both Australia and UK, former detainees are suing their own governments and have pressed legal action in their own countries for complicity with the U.S. in torture. They, you know, saying that they knew that they were subjected to extraordinary rendition, that they were, you know, complicit with U.S. interrogators in terms of providing information and even questions to be asked, for example. And what's quite interesting is that the way that the courts in the U.K. and in Australia have responded to these cases, some extraordinarily kind of ringing declarations by appeals courts in both countries about, you know, just absolutely making clear that torture is abhorrent and that it's, you know, their governments can't hide behind secrecy, that the cases, that the plaintiffs' or cases should be allowed to go forward. And have their claims of torture heard and receive compensation if they're found to be corroborated.
I have been paying a lot of attention to the documents that come out, but can you tell the audience a little bit about the process that goes into petitioning through FOIA to get these specific documents? And how do you know, for instance, what documents you're even looking for? Because, for instance, in the Ninth Circuit court case about wiretapping, the government wasn't going to tell anyone exactly what it had. That case, from what I remember, evolved out of either inference of documents and or evidence or something that was just basically a glimpse, and that was enough for the lawyers to seize upon. So how does this process come about a little bit, if you've got a moment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not going to give you probably an answer a whole lot more, you know, illuminating than maybe what you know. But But it's essentially, you know, you go at it with a broad request for all documents that relate to abuse of U.S. detainees under the, you know, under the Bush administration's war on terror. You know, you start there. What happened for the ACLU is that, you know, they've gotten many, many more documents from the Department of Defense than, say, from the CIA or from the OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel of the Justice Department. You get, you know, the documents, you'll get a, you know, after, well, you'll ask for them and they'll say no. Then you'll have to go to court, you know, you'll have to actually litigate. The court will rule that they have to release documents. They will release some documents, many of them heavily redacted. And then, you know, then you start to pick up clues. Of course, every time that there's, you know, news coverage, something comes out and you also get clues about what the documents are. But, you know, for instance, the interrogation videotapes of Abu Zubaydah and al-Nashiri at the CIA black site in Thailand, you know, we know that there were 97 videotapes that were destroyed by, or 92 videotapes, I'm sorry, that were destroyed by the CIA so that people could not see this, you know, clear documentary record of torture. Well, you know, they, in the original FOIA request, I don't believe they, you know, requested videotapes because nobody knew they were videotaping them. But, you know, then, you know, it became clear that the tapes had been destroyed. But, you know, but that clearly a destruction of those tapes would constitute, you know, a violation of the order to release the information that related to or illuminated prisoner abuse. So now you're litigating essentially contempt of court, right?
Right.
The CIA has destroyed documents that it was supposed to preserve and turn over. And so what the ACLU has done is asked for written records that provide any information about the tape's destruction or what was on the videotape. And then what you find out from then is that, in fact, the CIA had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of cables that went back and forth between the CIA black site and CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, every single day during the Abu Zubaydah interrogation. Those get produced because, in fact, that contains the same information that's on the videotape. You know, so you're sort of you're following these various threads, and you know, pulling out more and more information about what's in the record. Of course, they've lied about things. We didn't know that there were videotapes of Jose Padilla's interrogation, for example.
And I didn't know that.
You know, there was a videotape of his final interrogation before lawyers were finally allowed to see him at the military brig in Charleston. That videotape has conveniently disappeared. So, you know, that is a process. And, you know, of course, every time you get information, you know, huge amounts of it are redacted for various kinds of national security claims. And then you're litigating to, you know, get a little bit more erased every time. The most recent interesting example was, you know, the four reporters in Guantanamo who have been sort of expelled from further reporting in Guantanamo for reporting the name of a CIA interrogator that's now well known in the public record. But, you know, according to the secrecy rules of those proceedings, that name cannot be mentioned. So, you know, there's information that's out there, but you use that as clues to demand more information, which you then use to try to get things unredacted. And, you know, so that's where the process is now. There's 130,000 pages, you know, you're trying to get, of that 130,000 pages, there's probably 30% black boxes, you know, 30 to 40% of redacted material. And so you're trying to get that number diminished, and then you're trying to get the other documents that they still haven't released and are still withholding, and that includes key documents, or such key documents as, you know, the September 17th, 2001 Bush order that essentially gave the CIA the authority to set up, you know, black site prisons and run a forced disappearance torture program overseas.
And how do we know, for instance, when we get these documents that they will be what they say they are, that there's no alteration other than redaction? How do we know when we read these? I mean, I've read a lot of these, so I would assume that they are based on how they do contradict the very, very loud narrative for years. So that alone usually kind of validates it for me. But how do we know that? Do we have a way of knowing that?
Well, no. I mean, you know, this goes to, you know, fundamental bedrock principles of democratic, representative, accountable government. I mean, by law, the United States is required, the United States government is required to preserve documents, and if they're, if they are, there are a number of laws that govern how the government has to store its information, and when it's required to make it available, especially under Freedom of Information Act requests. And while I suppose we don't know, I would have to say that, there's been extremely damning material that's been released.
Right.
That's
what I'm saying. When you actually read them, there's enough information usually that are that way. But I've had people, because I usually recite them as my primary source instead of an article about it, when people have asked me, well, how do you know if what you read there is in fact accurate? And I usually say, for instance, if we're reading wires between folks, I'll say, well, I mean, I believe it's at least accurate between those two folks. Meaning that I may read something that's inaccurate, but the person putting it on paper at the time was probably being genuine to the moment, whatever that be. So if it was
that's certainly true. And here's an interesting thing, I think. You know, when you think of government voices, or government documents, I think that the kind of mistaken conception that you could have is this is 130,000 pages of dry, bureaucratic, impersonal voice, some machine-like bureaucratic voice, and that's hardly the case. I mean, there's nothing, there's, in fact, ironically, nothing more personal than government documents in some ways. And these documents are not written by one person, or they're not all written in, the voice of the official Bush-Cheney propaganda machine. They're full of voices of people who, many, many voices who are commenting on what's happening.
Are debating it.
Describing it, debating it, objecting to it. And there's an astonishing number of people who object to it.
I would like to actually start raising the names of the people who objected more on paper. Because there are some I have mentioned over the last few weeks. But there are even more in document form that the documents clearly show objections.
So. Well, absolutely. I mean, and it's not just a few. I mean, the entire FBI, as a bureau, essentially pulled out of and refused to participate in, enhanced interrogation technique interrogations in Guantanamo. And there's, there's an entire Justice Department FBI, investigation into the role of its agents, and it's a very carefully documented study of which agents objected and what the circumstances were and what led to the agency as a whole at the highest levels of the agency to pull its agents from any association with these programs. But there's even on the document a day that we're posting on the torture report, one of the things that I'm trying to pull feature is a number from the very first day, on the first day on June 1st, the posting was, just four separate incident reports that were filed by U.S. soldiers, in Guantanamo, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan, people out in the field who were in no position to know whether what they were seeing was, how much of a pattern it was, how much these techniques that they were seeing were, being sort of experimented with and exported from, one theater to another. None of that. All they knew is what they were seeing was wrong.
Which is a form of compartmentalization that prohibits, really, a paradigm view for any upfront soldier. I mean, a lot of these guys can come back and say, nothing happened around me, because they're shielded in some ways. They're isolated and compartmentalized.
Yeah, but these, here's four people who, things did happen around them, and they objected.
Yeah.
They said, look, this is, everything, there's the Army Field Manual. I know what the interrogation techniques are that accord with the Geneva Conventions. I know what the Geneva Conventions are. I know what my responsibilities are as a U.S. soldier. I know what my country stands for.
Mm-hmm.
And this ain't it, and so... again, when it goes to the veracity of the documents, this is not a government, propaganda monotone. There's, the documents are richly textured. You get many different perspectives on the single incidents, and so I think, I'm fully satisfied that, when I'm reading these documents, I'm getting a some really, really good clues, getting really close to what happened.
I had an email came in yesterday from somebody, a person who knows that I usually will have documents on hand, says, ask me if I had a verifiable position on whether or not CIA agents at the same black site as Ali Soufan, which would have been what, either Thailand or Indonesia? Do you remember?
Well, he was in,
Where was Abu Zubaydah?
Abu Zubaydah was in Thailand.
So
yeah.
So in Thailand, at the moment at which Ali Soufan basically objected, right before Mueller and then pulled it, there's this kind of ephemeral knowledge about CIA agents also objecting, thus really kind of leaving it more in the hands of these contractors. Is there, in the document dumps, do you find validity to that?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think about that for a second.
I mean, Soufan basically implied that there were agents there, CIA agents as well, not just the FBI agents, but some of the CIA agents there were also objecting to basically what the contractors were advising.
I think there might be something about that. I would look at the FBI, the Justice Department's FBI investigation.
Okay.
There's a good deal that covers the exchanges with Ali Soufan and another FBI agent who did not object as much as he did, actually.
Ah, interesting.
And remained behind when Ali Soufan left. But I can't recall off the bat, but I think there may be something about that.
And back to Guantanamo, there was the three suicides that happened in June of 2006. Do we have any reports on that have come out through these dumps?
Well, no, I'm trying to think. I mean, Scott Horton's piece
in Harper's.
What's that?
The one he did he interviewed a sergeant that was there who basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. I mean, as far as I know, the documentary evidence is, I haven't gotten that far in my narrative sort of chronologically, so I haven't done an exhaustive search on that.
Okay.
But I think if there was documentary evidence, it would certainly have been sort of part of Scott's story. And my understanding is that the documentary evidence is, more or less, in support of the official narrative that they were suicides and that sort of thing. His piece, like you say, was based on, supposedly, whistleblower interviews.
Right. And what about Bagram Salt Pit FOIA dumps? Do we have more documents on that?
Well, it was interesting because in the OLC, report finally that came out, we finally, by some mistake of redaction, learned the name of the man who was killed. For example. So that was interesting, and we know. I think the OLC report also sort of filled in a little bit of blanks. There were hints in the documents about things they call declination letters, which is, did the CIA seek and secure letters from the Justice Department declining to prosecute cases? And then I think there was some confusion about, whether or not they, there was a suggestion that the CIA had even sought declination letters in advance of, abusive interrogations, essentially inoculating itself, and, whether or not the, Justice Department ever issued those or sort of refused to. And there's some suggestion or, some of the records suggest that Condi Rice objected to, sort of advanced declinations. But in the OLC report, I know that there is some information that does suggest that the Justice Department did issue a declination letter in the Salt Pit case, that evidently after the fact, but a decline to prosecute case. We know that the CIA Inspector General, who his report remains, I think, one of the biggest windows into the CIA's rendition, detention, and interrogation program. It indicated that he had been asked to look at two particular deaths. One of them was a Salt Pit death. He indicated that he had referred that and then at least another incident or so to the Justice Department, referred them for prosecution, and the Justice Department had declined. So,
last question is about the Obama administration. Do we have any evidence, because it percolates around, that the Obama administration is continuing rendition policies and or black site policies? I should actually, let me clarify, extraordinary rendition policies and black site policies.
I haven't seen any, no.
Okay.
I haven't seen any. Right. You know, that's not, I'm trying to think of what the official scope of the FOIA request is. I think it's, you know, they would have to probably refile a request.
Okay.
But I have, you know, I haven't seen any. I certainly hope to God that we're not doing it. I think it would be, you know, obviously an extreme, extreme mistake and miscalculation in terms of world opinion. All it takes is, you know, about 10 minutes outside of the United States to understand the extreme harm that the United States has done to its international reputation, to its international influence, you know. And I think anybody who, you know, has any doubts about, you know, whether or not torture is effective or whether or not it makes us safer, you know, really should think about, you know, how much we really depend for our safety on being able to exert some kind of credible influence, you know, on the world. And you know, you spend a little bit of time outside of the United States and you can see the damage that's been done. You can see the, you know, the repair that was done by, you know, by making a decisive shift in administrations and by the promises that, you know, the Obama administration has made to change these policies. So, you know, I think that the administration certainly understands the importance of these issues, you know, for the security of the United States. And so I have to believe that, you know.
An invaluable organization, the ACLU. For those who do not understand the ACLU, I would invite you to take a real good look. I really enjoyed the conversation with you. I hope you will come back and we will talk more about these details. The radio station's main purpose is accountability and understanding the actual implications of the global war on terror. Really in-depth examination of the torture records and trying to understand how a country that was so enwrapped in its own values could head down, as Jane Mayer quoted from Dick Cheney, the dark side, you know. So,
right.
So Larry, I want to thank you for joining us, and you'll come back?
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, brother. Have a good weekend.
Enjoy the conversation. All right, see ya. Bye.
Next up, Colleen Rowley and I discuss Torture Awareness Month, the Free Gaza Flotilla, the Median, and more.
This afternoon, there's an emergency march on the issue of the Israeli attack of the flotilla. And we're a group that's going to march from our capital to Minnesota Trade Commission that's invested in a couple of Israel's bonds.
Ah.
So that starts at 3 o'clock. So I'm going to probably participate in that. And then tomorrow, I'm in the Women Against Military Madness, which is kind of a version, it's an older ladies' version of Code Pink that's been around for 20 years.
Is Ann Wright in there?
Ann Wright actually participates a lot with Code Pink, mm-hmm. although she, you know, a lot of us have many affiliations, I think,
sure.
And she's a vet for peace. She's a veteran for peace first. But I think, you know, she goes to a ton of stuff that's Code Pink organized. And here in the Twin Cities, we don't have a Code Pink, actually, because I'm sure there are many people like myself who are on Code Pink's mailing list and whatever. But we've had this group called Women Against Military Madness. The acronym is WAM, for 28 years. And so it kind of has, you know, occupied the area of attracting women who are, you know, peaceniks. So this, tomorrow, our number one defense contractor in the state of Minnesota is Alliant Tech Systems.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a particularly bad one because they produce cluster bombs as well as depleted uranium.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's been this long, I want to say 2 or 3 decade effort get them to stop producing these weapons. And so tomorrow, WAM is doing its Walk Against Weapons, a 3-mile walk, which I think it's their third annual and I'm that's another thing. My calendar is really full.
So whose district is that in? District does that company
operate? Alliant Tech Systems is in. It's the congressman in that district now is Paulson, Eric Paulson. Jim Ramstead. But it was out in Edina, and now it is switched to Eden Prairie.
And has he been sympathetic to them, as often is the case when representatives have powerful interest in their district?
Oh, of course. Eric Paulson's Jim Ramstead was a Republican, but he was a centrist Republican.
Right.
And then in 2000, last election, Eric Paulson, who is a right-wing Republican. So he's obviously, he's very pro-war, and certainly Alliant Tech Systems. I haven't checked to see if he gets contributions from them, but I would be surprised if he wasn't.
Well, let's take a look. I'll tell you what. I want to talk about Torture Awareness Month, and we'll talk about the events you have. But I want to stick with the conversation a little bit about the flotilla. So I want to stay with the Israeli flotilla for a minute.
Okay.
I was asking you online yesterday if we for instance we know that. Turkey examined these ships before they left, and I had posed what I consider to be a reasonable, not really suspicion, but just what would seem evident that Israeli intelligence, most likely U.S. intelligence as well, Turkish intelligence, Jordanian intelligence, would have also implanted someone in that area to make sure the real weaponry, Katyusha rockets and such, were not on their way to Gaza.
Right.
That
right.
Seem reasonable to you?
Of course. Even my knowledge from the planning of the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, where Americans, different groups of American protesters were gathering to march on the Republican National Convention. Guess what? The Sheriff's Department, the FBI, they had 3, 4, 5 informants that inserted themselves in groups, and it happened pretty quickly, just in a matter of a couple of months. Mm-hmm. So there are no longer any restraints on doing that kind of thing, even domestically, as there were as there was before 9/11. The FBI had these guidelines, Attorney General guidelines that applied and that restricted your ability to plant informants and stuff, and that all ended. So now it's the first thing that's done, and certainly in international, intelligence agencies, that's their job. And of course, they'd be inept if they weren't gathering intelligence.
Exactly.
Your best sources are informants. They pay people. Certainly, there are people that I'm sure it was somewhat easy to register as an activist to be on these ships. They don't have a screening or anything like that. So all you do is you register, or you get a friend to register. It would be a simple matter to find out.
Yeah, I received notices about this from the organizers over the last several weeks. It was the most constant email campaign I had. So it would seem that well announced that there's little doubt. First off, that the idea that this is an ambush would make it laughable.
Right.
It's the slowest ambush in history. But also the having scanned the vessels, we now know that clearly that there were no, other than lawn chairs and sticks and hose, that there were no real tangible weapons.
Well, and operating with transparency and openness. If you're a group that's organizing, it doesn't behoove you to organize in a secret way unless you have some nefarious purpose. If you're trying to do something openly and above board, now the downside of that is, you can have many, many people spying on you. You would think, though, that would actually prove to be a safeguard, because, as you said, if there were all these spies that were checking the cargo, they would know that there were no weapons in there.
Yeah, it basically doesn't really make sense. So let's move on to some stateside issues.
Well, it does make sense if you're trying to set something
well,
up.
Well, that's true, yes, if you're trying to control the narrative.
It makes sense if the intelligence is not the goal. That's what it makes sense. So if your goal was to stop weapons from getting into Gaza, yes, then it would make no sense. But if that was not your goal, if the intelligence actually was not your goal, if it was to, basically a PR thing, which is to cast aspersions on the efforts of the people to stop the blockade. If that was your goal, then it's completely different.
And are you aware, I've been asking a few different guests, are you aware of international laws as it would relate to Israel's right to do this and or the protection of the ship? Because frankly, if I were in international waters and any state vehicle wanted to board my ship, I might not resist. It might not seem very logical for me to resist. But if I were, it seems like I would be well within my right to do so.
Well, the law, I think Craig Murray, that former ambassador to Great Britain, has put out a couple of things. And I think, from what I know, at least he's right. If you're on the high seas and you're flying a particular country's flag, your ship then is governed by the law of that country.
Okay.
So the high seas otherwise are anybody's, you know, it can be anybody out there. So if a ship is flying a Turkish flag, then that ship is governed by Turkish law. And if another country decides to unilaterally, you know, stop it and board it, it's basically declaring war. I mean, that is an act of war.
Right.
Now, whether the international situation right now politically would recognize that, and certainly it wouldn't behoove, I don't think there's any chance that Turkey is going to say, you know, that was an act of war and we've been provoked into war or anything like that. But that's what it is. You know, it's not even piracy. And I was kind of debating with a couple of Facebook friends, because there are people, certainly the nonviolent movement of Gandhi and Martin Luther King, is if you are sitting at a lunch counter, if you go back to the 60s and the civil rights movement, you're sitting at the lunch counter and they're beating on you. Which happened, you know, people are spitting on you, beating on you, whatever. It is the much more, from a nonviolent standpoint, not to retaliate, not even to you know, use a harsh word back, but just to take it. And so there are many people who saw the bars, you know, they picked up bars alongside the ship that were there and hit some of the people who are, you know, propelling down and saying, well, that you're not following Gandhi's nonviolent movement. But on the other hand, it's very hard just to take it if the shots are coming in, and certainly the testimony now is that they're tear gassing and they were even firing down on people's heads and stuff. To just say, well, I'm going to stand here and die and not fight back, that is extremely difficult for people to do.
One report had this morning, I'm still trying to see if I can, how close I can source it, that five people were killed with headshots. And one person was killed at a headshot so close it was anywhere from 2 centimeters to 12 centimeters.
Wow. So this narrative that Israel is trying to put out about this being self-defense and whatever, it just doesn't hold water factually. And yet, you know, I'm even on my Facebook friends, I have quite a number of people who are sympathetic to Israel. And it's kind of amazing, you know, it's an amazing thing, this cognitive dissonance now, when you have two competing versions, certainly as being a prior investigator right. in the FBI, this is the state of all cases. As a victim will tell you one story, a witness might tell you another, and the perpetrator will tell you still a third story. And a court, and when you go into court now, you put all those stories out there before a jury, you put the hard evidence, and then a jury gets to decide exactly what happened. They don't necessarily always come up with the truth of the matter, but they do. But you have a definitive resolution because you have a jury. Now, in international law, you have no juries and you have no courts, at least not for the United States, because we're above it. We will not commit to have, you know, being subject to the International Criminal Court. Israel will not even subject itself to investigation by the United Nations.
Right.
And so what you have now is, and people are saying, well, why won't we ever know the truth? Well, because we're not in a nation state that has an enforcement mechanism or a criminal justice mechanism designed to get the truth. And yes, every case is like this. There are competing stories in every case you have. Oh, I would say every once in a while, maybe somebody confesses right from the start and there's not that competing stories, but that's not the normal one, is that there's many different versions. But the facts typically will lead a jury to see, you know, that, oh, well, he's saying he's innocent, but, you know, the forensic expert testified this way, and if he's saying this, it can't possibly be that way.
Well, yeah, in my case, I have friends that live in Sderot who've had to run from rockets, people who've had to return that now live in the United States who returned back to Israel for fear of their families. You know, it's a palpable fear. But in doing investigation for journalism or trying to divine what actually happened, yeah, I have to put those loyalties aside. Same thing, loyalties I have of people who go back and forth into Gaza for humanitarian work. I put all those things aside because I need to know actually what happened. So I think that's a very good point. For the people who may not understand what you and I might accept an internet dialogue, peace organizations are not monolithic. And you often have a portion of the group that wants a little bit more action than talk. And like you said, that they're often in demonstrations. For instance, you'll get someone who lays out the caveat, hey, you know, don't get into it with the police officers and such. But by and large, they're pretty good operators. You know, what's your thought on, for instance, you know, the idea that Turkey supported this, and this is an operation between the White House and Turkey to embarrass Israel and all these other things. This seems really other planet to me, because I've been involved in organization movements before.
And I think what you have to do when you're judging this type of thing, there certainly are some peace groups that are totally pacifist. And again, they adhere strictly to the Gandhi and Martin Luther King principles. If you go back to the civil rights, there was that great debate between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And Malcolm X, and actually I had these same debates when I was in college. You know, they would talk about nonviolence, you know, they were talking about Gandhi, and I said, yeah, but it wasn't really truly nonviolent. It was just nonviolent for the one side, because the side that's nonviolent and sitting there has to absorb the violence. Some of them are killed, even in Gandhi's efforts. It wasn't nonviolent. They were being beat and they were killed. Now they didn't fight back. And so you're talking about that Quaker where, right, you know, slap the cheek and you don't slap back. And I agree with that, by the way. I'm one of the people, I'm not a complete pacifist, but I agree that nonviolence works. I don't think that a violent response is going to help anything. I think it just tends to ratchet it up, and violence begets violence. So I'm with Gandhi and Martin Luther King. But Malcolm X, you know, they did that, have this argument, and there are some points on his side about the idea that justification and social justice. And I think when you get the social justice and peace combined, because peace alone is meaningless, it's got to be a fairness in there. It's got to be justice along with peace. And when you get that combined, yes, you do see groups that say that you have to take more action. You can't just, you know, there's this whole idea of just talking or you know, if going along with things instead of fighting back. And I think you do have to fight back, at least verbally, and you do have to, you certainly, if you have a horrific situation of Gaza and a genocide, people do have to speak up. You know, it's complicity if you do nothing and if you watch things being happening. All it takes for evil to prevail is for good people to do nothing. And so I do think you have to do stuff, and I just don't agree that using violence will help your cause. And I think Israel, what you're seeing right now is that this is all blowing back now, and many Jewish people who love Israel and want to see Israel remain for another day are seeing that this violent actions that they're taking is actually hurting their cause.
Right.
And did you see the interview with Peck, who was the former U.S. ambassador to Iraq this morning?
I have seen two. I didn't see one this morning. I saw one with Greta Van Susteren and one with Keith Olbermann.
Yeah, I saw the one with Keith Olbermann. And I thought he made the best points here, because he's making the very pragmatic argument. You know, oftentimes as liberal, you know, they call us liberal peaceniks or whatever. You make these ethical arguments,
right,
or even legal arguments. And I've always told people, well, people don't care about the ethics and the legal, but if you explain how the ethics and the legal are entwined with the pragmatic consequences,
right,
that's where you'll finally make some headway. And Peck did a great job of this.
What was that on? I'll find it.
It was the Olbermann one that I was watching.
Okay. Well, then I'll pull that up and we'll take a listen to that for the show. That brings me to a question about holding U.S. officials accountable for torture in light of the, although not recorded, and not some way recorded, I should say, audio or video apparently, George Bush saying something that actually I felt like he probably already said that before. It didn't seem like it was news to me, but that we authorized waterboarding. So did.
Cheney has been saying a lot.
Sure, he said that in December of 2008 right. on the ABC interview and the subsequent interviews.
Right,
but,
and I, you know, obviously by Bush finally, either one of two things. Bush, you know, is not the smartest bulb in the room, and so it's possible he didn't even realize he had not admitted it before. That's possible. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is he has no way of not, that this is not going to get him anywhere by denying, so he's realizing he's got to now stay with Cheney.
Yeah.
When Cheney first began to admit the waterboarding, many of our group of veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity were just a little bit surprised because we said, well, by admitting that now, he really is kind of hanging Bush out to dry.
Right.
You know, and so now Bush must have recognized I don't really have any arguments left there. I've got to just go along with Cheney. I've got to be on his side. So it's now up to, of course, our country, American people, I would say, not so much the Congress. They've shown themselves to be very spineless on this. But individuals under international law, you know, certain judges in the world, like the Spanish judge and the Italian judges that held the 22 CIA agents accountable. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be individuals like that in the judiciary that are going to be the first finally to hold accountable these very highly illegal actions that occurred and frankly I worry are still occurring.
I guess my thought started in that with thinking about that the Peacenik group, and I may even be engaged in a stereotype, but as I've shared with you before, I do have a lot of background with the same groups, is that they can be cooperative to a fault, you know, where everyone's included to the point where almost nothing happens because
right.
everyone has to be involved and everyone has to be
well,
honored.
That's kind of what I was trying
yeah.
to say. I didn't explain that very well, but that's exactly when I was saying that the people who really feel like being peace is an inner peace, okay?
Right.
So there are people in the peace movement that means peace for myself.
Right.
So I've got inner peace and I'm like, I sit there in my little Buddhist chant and that makes me a peacenik. Or I pray for peace. Pete Seeger has a great line in Bring 'Em Home where he says, I forget what song, but it's a song where he's singing, but then he goes into a talk in the middle of it and he says, you know, and when all the old people had learned how to go along and not make waves and blah, 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 then the young people came along and they showed us how to be brave. And the song is We Shall Overcome, by the way, I just remembered. And
yeah.
the next verse after he talks is, we are not afraid. And he's talking about the civil rights movement.
Right.
And that part about the we are not afraid, obviously many of the peace community these days is our people over 60, 70, even 80 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. Maybe people do become a little more afraid as they grow older. And when you're 16, 17, 18, as the young people were during Vietnam, and as the young civil rights activists were in the early 60s, they were all, you know, young 20-year-olds.
Right.
And what I guess my point was I didn't say so well was the bravery. Just because you're a pacifist doesn't mean you're a coward. You have to be brave as hell
yeah.
to do these things. And
right.
and it takes extreme bravery to go to a lunch counter and sit there while they're spitting at you and march in the face of dogs and everything else. And obviously to have been on that boat, that flotilla boat,
right.
while paratroopers are coming down and shooting. Can you imagine to not completely melt or pick up?
Can you
up
imagine
a,
being Rachel Corrie as a caterpillar
exactly,
bulldozer?
Exactly. You know, and I think people do confuse the things. They confuse peace with some kind of going along and not being brave enough to stand. Even in debating, I've noticed this. I'm on the torture issues.
Right.
I'm not the most conversant with Geneva Conventions. I did study international law, but that was a long time ago.
Sure.
And I certainly can't pull out, you know, verse by verse this Geneva Convention or the other. So if I was to debate, we have a couple of authors of the torture memos that are law professors, of course, John Yu, and we have one in the Twin Cities. Robert Delahunty was a co-author with John Yu of the key, actually it's a key memo that says the Geneva Conventions do not apply to non-state actors. And that was signed already in January of 2002, long before they even caught Zubaydah and started the torture tactics. So that memo actually is the foundation for the torture. It's not the John Yu Bibi memo in August 1st. The Yu Delahunty memo is what sets the thing. So this guy teaches law at St. Thomas Law School, and we do protests there, and we'll have law students, you know, saying, you're wrong, Delahunty's a great guy, there's nothing wrong with his memos, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And they're all being taught, by the way, that the Geneva Conventions do not apply, which basically says now that you can torture. I mean, it's incredible. So that's the real worry, is that there's no way that torture can end our country's practice when we still have these law professors that are teaching that there's nothing wrong with what we did.
And the co-opted media.
Right, right.
That plays an argument as equal sum when they sit side by side, when in fact you can have a completely erroneous, factually inaccurate or something position sitting next to a factual argument, and it's not an ideological argument, it's fact-based.
Right. Now, going back to what I was trying to say about the bravery to even debate somebody like a Robert Delahunty or a Federalist Society lawyer who holds these war powers views,
right.
We're trying, I mean, this is going to lead right into Torture Awareness Month. We think that the way to make a difference, to make a dent into public opinion, is not to just talk amongst ourselves in the church basements and not to, preach to our own side. We're all against torture, and we've had enough of these 10, 20 people sitting in a church basement all in agreement that torture is a bad thing.
Hear, hear.
So what we tried to do is on Sunday, June 27th in the Twin Cities, we were going to try to get a debate going, because we have three law professors here who are ardent proponents of war powers and torture, and they're all strongly affiliated with the Bush administration. And we thought, okay, if we can bring in somebody who can debate them on the Geneva Conventions, and we got Marjorie Cohn, mm-hmm. who was the former president of the National Lawyers Guild. We've got two law professors here. One is the head of a genocide study center at the U, and one is the head of a peace and justice group at St. Thomas.
Ellen Kennedy and Jack Nelson Palmer.
Right, and then the third is the Muslim chaplain mm-hmm. at Guantanamo, James Yee, mm-hmm. who was falsely accused of, like, you know, being a terrorist himself or whatever.
Right.
So those four were coming. Now, we tried to get Robert Delahunty, who is the law professor who co-authored the early memos with John Yu that said the Bill of Rights did not apply, that said treaties do not apply, that said the Geneva Conventions did not apply. He's in Rome teaching, so he declined. His mentor, Robert Delahunty's mentor, is a former Office of Legal Counsel professor by the name of Michael Stokes Paulson. And he actually testified in April 2009 to Congress that there was nothing wrong with any of the memos written by Office of Legal Counsel, including the Yu Bibi ones. And he has got this long explanation about why they were perfect law. There's
was
nothing wrong.
Was that the
wrong.
Senate hearing? Was that the?
Yep. No, yeah. It was in the House, I think.
House. Okay, I think I remember that.
Yep. And his name's Stokes Paulson. Actually, they had two law professors, Lubin, I think of Georgetown, Ali Soufan, the former FBI agent. There were four people that testified, and he was on the side that there was nothing wrong. Anyways, he's one. We have not heard a response back from him, but I think it means that he's not interested. And then the third law professor that we invited, and I think he would have done it, except he's also got a conflict or out of the country, is the former assistant CIA legal counsel, John Radson, who served under Rizzo right during the time, and he's testified to Congress a few times about these issues of the torture memos. And he's a proponent of extraordinary war powers in the war on terrorism, that we need new legal, he actually argues that we need to codify and legalize targeted assassinations and things like that. Now, Radson's unique because he's actually not wrong. He's not wrong in his argument that we need law to protect the CIA, poor guys at the bottom here, who are following orders, pressing those buttons, for instance, that will do the targeted assassination or drone bombing. So he makes the argument that the poor people that you're ordering to do this at the bottom levels, and I think that's actually why we got the torture memo, is because Rizzo realized in July that when Condi had delivered this order to Tenet, it's your baby, go do it. Rizzo and the lawyers at the CIA realized, well, this is great and well, you're telling us to do this, but what's our protection? When the people find out in our country about waterboarding, they're going to hold, just like Lindy England, you're going to be going after our CIA guys, and Bush and Cheney will be running for the hills, and there will be no documents about their orders to tell us to do this.
Right.
And that's what brought in, that's when you and Bybee says, oh, don't worry about that, we'll legalize it. And that's when they wrote the memo. Well, Radson's a proponent for legalizing all of these truly illegal things, like targeted assassination is the latest one. It's truly illegal under international law to do this type of thing. We are, you know, obviously Obama has given the order to do it with respect to Yemenis, right. And yet, under international law, it's extremely, it's murky. It's, I guess the best you could say is the law, you maybe can make some arguments. There are a couple of law professors in the United States making arguments that it's fine, but even they hedge when they do so. I saw a testimony in Congress on this recently, and the two that were saying, oh, it's nothing to worry about, were still hedging in their language. So we thought we could get him, and he declined. So what we're doing now is we're going to do an educational forum, and maybe we'll have a straw man up there, you know, just posing some interesting questions or something, just to make it more of a little bit more of a debate. But this is on June 27th, the day after the UN's has for many years on June 26th declared it to be a torture awareness day for the victims of torture. And then church groups like the National Religious Campaign Against Torture and other torture victim groups have declared the entire month of June to be Torture Awareness Month. And so we came up with a bunch of things. One of the other things we're doing during Torture Awareness Month in June is an everyday vigil in front of our U.S. courthouse. And this vigil, we've done it for 6 months now, but usually it's just one or two of us out there. But we are in orange jumpsuits with black hoods, and we have signs that say waiting for justice, you know, prosecute, investigate war crimes, Bagram, Abu Ghraib, Uzbekistan. So we have little signs. And then we hand out flyers, and the flyers that we're handing out to people walking into the courthouse are many times to judges, magistrates, and prosecutors, and certainly to FBI agents, et cetera. So it's kind of a high-value place. If you want to educate people on torture, is to go in front of your local federal courthouse. And we're doing that every weekday in the month of June, trying to get more people. We're doing showings of the film Torturing Democracy. Mm-hmm. And then we have some other panel discussions. And then our Center for Victims of Torture is doing an all-day event on the 26th, where they're having people from various countries who have been the victims of torture speak out. The groups that we have in the Twin Cities, it's really good. We've got the ACLU, the National Lawyers Guild, the Amnesty International, our Center for Victims of Torture, and our group is called Tackling Torture at the Top, which is a committee of the Women Against Military Madness. So, and we're trying to also, I guess we'll be writing a little bit more op-eds and things, trying to tell people in other states that that you can lobby your congresspersons, and certainly just by going into their office and trying and educating, most representatives are not even going to know what happened under the Bush administration. They have not had the time to read all these.
They have lightweight information from some of the ones I've had to opportunity to speak with.
Right.
Public narrative level.
Right. And, of course, depending on the party, now if they're Republicans in many cases, they will be on this war powers notion that the war powers basically excuse. When you're in a war, anything goes. And the president, as an executive, can violate the laws. I mean, that's kind of the argument, is that all other laws, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, the treaties, all must give way when you're in a war, because the executive must do what it takes to win the war.
Which only shows why holding the executive power to account each time is so vitally important, because even I might call back at something as precedent when it's a bad precedent. You know, I don't think I have the imperial knowledge of all things good and bad, but I know I can look back at things and say, well, the president chose to do that, therefore what, he has the power? Or do I have to look at it in a historical context and say, well, they took that power, yes, but then we did come along later and say, you didn't really have that power, and the Supreme Court and or legislation through Congress.
Right.
Amended that power, or right. Adjusted
and,
that.
Well, you're going to see in history. Well, let's use the detention of the Japanese during World War II is a great example. I mean, it took how many decades? The guy that challenged that was a guy named Fred Korematsu, And he challenged it right at the time and lost. I actually had a chance to meet him once. He's dead now. He died a couple years ago, but I met him at an ACLU conference. He was a speaker. And he lost, but decades later, they re-argued that as a civil matter and actually won. So it took, you know, I don't know if it was 30, 40 years later before, or 50 years maybe even, before it was recognized that this was wrong. Another similar example is how long it takes the public and culture and officials who are complicit themselves. If you have public officials who are still in office, who were briefed, for instance, on Pelosi and the rest, were briefed on these things, and maybe they weren't fully briefed. They should have said, well, you didn't tell me all of the specifics, but they feel complicit. Now they feel helpless to stand up and say it was wrong because they were part of it. When I was in college, I spent my junior year in France, in the south of France, in Montpellier. I was a French major. And that year, they kept having World War II movies that came out in France. François Truffaut had his famous Small Change, and there were all these. The third movie that I got drugged to by my French friends, and it was about a World War II scene, I said, why are you so fixated? This is 1976. Why are all your filmmakers in France making movies about World War II? That's long past history. And the French friends I had turned to me and said, oh, Colleen, you do not understand. This is the first time we've been able to admit that the Vichy regime was complicit.
Yeah.
And so if you subtract 76, it was 1976 that I spent in France, 76 from 41, 42, what do you got there? 33, 34 years that it took the French to admit to themselves that they were complicit.
Right.
And that's, they couldn't even make movies before that to show that what had happened.
Do you think that would, this may not, well, it will be a little bit similar. Do you think that that's what's going to happen in Spain related to Garzón's, the recent flap over Garzón? You know, he's well known now to many of us because of his extra jurisdictional authority campaign with Rumsfeld and everyone. But when he brought up deaths from within the Civil War, it pissed some people off. Apparently in Spain you don't do that.
Right. Well, so, and of course, you know, that's the biblical, that you can see the speck in the other's eye, but you can't see the log in your own.
Right.
And that is, our country can point out the torture that occurs in Uzbekistan and China.
Right.
And if we're going to, when we file our State Department annual report on torture and civil liberties and whatever, we can point out all these other countries that are not doing things right. But yet, our own country, who did, you know, terrible things, waterboarding, targeted assassinations, nobody can speak a word about it. And it is that proverb about, or, you know, that it's easy to see in somebody else. But, you know,
well, two aspects about the Garzón thing, though. Don't you think, just like you said about France finally having to face its own history, Spain will do the same for its civil war.
Oh, yeah.
America will eventually have to do the same thing over and over again.
Right.
Now, the second part that you were touching on mainly is
It may take a while.
Indeed. The extra jurisdictional argument, I found when anyone on this side was assailing him for it, in direct ironic contrast to our invasion of two countries using the exact same principles that we have the right to take justice wherever we need to take justice,
right,
was thick. I mean, it's really...
Yeah. No, under, you know, international law has come to evolve to where it is for a reason. And if you go back to the Nuremberg principles, you know, they call it the greatest generation who fought to establish,
right,
the Geneva, you know, basically to establish that aggressive war, a war of aggression, is the supreme crime.
Right.
And it established actually that torture under no circumstances, war is not an excuse for torture. All came out of World War II and the Nuremberg principles.
Right.
And many of our great, some, I wouldn't say many, but there are certainly a couple of statesmen now who are saying, our situation now, we've just sacrificed everything we gained. As bad as World War II was, we did gain some good principles out of it. And we've just sacrificed those now. And go back to your war of aggression. You know, what do we call it? Preemptive.
Right.
It's great to be... to launch a preemptive war, because we've got to beat them to the punch. It's always explained, even with the flotilla. It was explained that the reason that they had to stop that boat before it got into Israel's borders is they had to preempt that from happening. So they keep pushing it to earlier and earlier. Well, obviously, a preemptive war or a preventative war is a war of aggression. I mean, it's the same thing. Nobody will say that, but it is an illegal... actually, some international law professors said this before the war was launched on Iraq. They said this is totally illegal under international law.
Right.
Because it's a war of aggression. I said it, too.
Aside from it being a fabrication.
Mm-hmm. And if you can imagine preemptive, for instance, justice, if we were to say that when I worked the mafia cases in New York City...
Right.
We knew that John Gotti was the head of the Gambino family.
Right.
We actually had a lot of evidence in the FBI files that John Gotti had been the person responsible for assassinating Paul Castellano, the former boss of the Gambino, and then he was the one who took over, whatever. So we had a lot of evidence, a lot of informants, whatever. Now, if we wanted to use that to preempt, we wouldn't have to rely on court system. We would just go out there, we'd say, the FBI, go get John Gotti. Do a preemptive act. That would be preemptive justice. And you know, in a way, this idea of using, it's bad enough to be forced to use violence when you are attacked. That's bad enough. The law says, if you are attacked as a country, you can defend yourself. Okay, that's what international law is.
Right.
But to use violence to defend yourself, even from a violent attack, is a bad thing. And I think it actually does ratchet it up. I think that violence begets violence.
Sure.
However, think about what even a worse situation. Now we don't have to wait to be attacked to defend ourselves. We get to even jump the gun. We get to go out there and say, you might attack us. Someday, this country, Iraq, Iran, you might pose a danger to us. Afghanistan now, the argument is that the Taliban might get control and might, if they get control, then become a safe haven for terrorists who might attack us someday. Okay, that's the argument. And so we're allowed to make sure that that won't happen through violent force. Now that, fortunately, completely violates the Nuremberg principles. Those were the same arguments that Hitler was making.
Right.
And unfortunately, we've gone down this path now, and we violated international law. And I don't know how it's all going to end. I think that it takes many, many people to be, when I speak, you know, it's not to hear myself speak, and it's not to like today, to go march this afternoon. In Minnesota, we're going to have a march in opposition to the Israeli attack of the flotilla. You know, it's not to get my exercise marching. It's to encourage more people to speak out, to write, to act, to essentially be brave, because it's the only thing that's going to put Pandora's, the evils that were let out of Pandora's box. It's the only thing is a lot of people, mass participation, getting all of those evils, torture and things like that, that are out there floating around right now and causing, wrecking all kinds of havoc. And it's going to take all of us to get those, to put them back in the box. We all want to hope that, you know, the election, you know, people thought, thank goodness Obama got elected. He'll do that. He'll put those things back in the box. He'll change. He'll be the change. And all of a sudden, I won't have to worry about this anymore. Well, that was never the case.
Right.
One person couldn't even, I don't care if they walked on water, one person cannot do this job. It requires really, you know, a lot of people. I don't know if it requires 90% of the country or 80% or 70%, maybe 51% of our country.
Well, we have to remember the Revolutionary War was basically launched and sustained through the majority of itself with less than 60% of the colonists. A majority of the colonists, from what I've understood over the years, especially I learned it as an adult more than I did as a child, was that the majority of the people just didn't want to rock the boat,
right.
Stay with the king. You know, they didn't like it, but, you know, don't change things. That might become unusual for us.
Well, you know, if you look at social psychology, when I teach ethics, I point to Solomon Esch and Stanley Milgram, who did all these testings about how people are basically apathetic and go with the flow.
Okay.
Solomon Esch had the line test, which is that three people in a group would come in, and he had three lines of differing lengths, and it was clear to see that one was a shorter line.
Right.
But by prior agreement, he had the first two pick the longest line. And when that happened, 69, I'll bet you anything, the 69% translates to the same apathy that you had in the Revolutionary War of people
right.
wanting to go along, the same apathy you see almost on every single issue. When you're the third person and the other two people have picked the demonstrably shorter line, you go with those other two because you want to be a part of the group and you want to be popular and you don't want them to think you're stupid. All these reasons that humans don't want to do brave things and whatever. And I think that to overcome that, again, is difficult, and it's what we need to do. We need to constantly be pushing for people to become more, to become braver in the face of wrongdoing. And basically, they can't even see the wrongdoing because, like you said, these people couldn't even see the line was shorter because they were so wanting to please those other two people.
Right.
And Stanley Milgram did the same test, only he did it with an electric voltage test. And the same thing applies. 60-some percent of people will push a button to give an electric voltage of 400 volts to somebody in another room if they're trying to please a scientist in a white coat who looks like he's in a position of authority.
Right.
I wrote this letter to the editor yesterday about the Israeli attack on the flotilla
mm-hmm.
and how it was open and above the waves. Their cargo had been inspected. And I contrasted that with Israel's now deploying of nuclear armed subs that are under the water, and not only are the submarines location secret, but the fact that Israel even possesses 200 or 300 nuclear bombs is secret. So the secrecy of what's going on simultaneously with Israel deploying these submarines off the coast of Iran, I hope we just cross our fingers they won't use them, but
right.
They're under the water and they're secret with the flotilla that was completely transparent and open, had been inspected, etc. And certainly, like we just talked about, their intelligence agents were probably on board that ship.
Right.
I mean, the contrast is stark. So I printed this letter, and guess what? Just got attacked royally by these comments that basically are saying, you know, Colleen Raleigh is going against authority here. That's what she's disgraced herself by not going with the flow. You know, that's the type of comments, because if they can make you seem like you are that third person who doesn't agree with the other two, it makes you feel bad. It makes you think that, oh my gosh, these other people out there think I'm awful and terrible because I disagree with them. Anyways, I had about 40, 50 comments that are basically all this authoritarian themed
right.
comments. To make me feel bad that I would write such a things, you know, about nuclear armed submarines. You're supposed to be quiet. If that's supposed to be secret, then you just better keep your mouth shut, that no one should know that there are nuclear-armed submarines. Incredible. Incredible.
Well,
situation.
In my role here, my job is to shine light on items. And also in your comment there, you referred to Lord Acton's comment that everything secret degenerates. And in the media, and we'll leave this as a final thought, I want to talk about your run-in with Chris Bury. But I'll set it up with a story from a little over a year ago that I think is a little similar. Do you remember the Hillary Clinton hospital story from during the primaries? Did you hear about that?
I'm not sure.
Okay, so she had come under flak over the Bosnia. I came in under gunfire. She said that on St. Patrick's Day. And then a few weeks later, there was this story about a hospital in southern Ohio where she had visited a sheriff on December 28th. In fact, she did that, and then she came to Houston, and I happened to film her event in Houston. She tells this story. She goes on the road telling the story about healthcare. Eventually, the story is picked up, and the media runs to this little town of Ohio. It basically impugns the local sheriff, impugns Hillary Clinton, and her campaign even retracted their story, saying, oh, well, I guess we were wrong, and everyone started pulling the story back. Well, something was a little odd for me because I heard her statement for the first time that night. I actually played the sheriff's statement to her. There was nothing wrong with the story. I dug and dug and finally called the guy, and I said, look, I'm doing a story for NewQuarter, and I'd like to ask you some details. He told me the story. I said, well, how's everyone getting it so wrong? He goes, because no one's listening. They're after Hillary Clinton.
Right.
And they're just not going to tell the story. So I asked him, well, what really happened? And the bottom line of that story, before we talk about Chris Bury, is that there was a woman in southern Ohio who had been denied health care from a major company, Holzner Medical, and I'll name them, no problem. Because I looked up, having grown up under a law, one of my family members works in a big law firm and has for most of my life. And I said, well, there's got to be some class actions or something. Sure enough, boom, just within hours of just a little bit of digging, lots of class actions against them for billing and denial of service and such. So the bottom line of the story is that all the national media ran over the story, got it wrong.
Right.
Until and I even wrote to them and said, wrote to ABC, called them, mm-hmm. called CNN, called everyone, said, you got the story wrong. In fact, it is true. And here's the important part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Only Ann Kornblut and Jake Tapper, that, to the best of my knowledge, reversed their stories. So,
wow.
How does you ran into Chris Bury in a similar situation where they came up with this kind of pre-notion of what they want to talk about and just kind of like, boom, landed on you. How did that work out?
Well, it was a trap for me because I'd only been standing at this 9/11 truth conference for about 10 minutes. They had just arrived. I was standing in the back, and a young woman, nice, pleasant young woman, came up and said, ABC is here. I'm with ABC, and can we interview you? And I said, oh, yeah, sure. And I thought to myself, oh, my goodness, why would I actually did. It was like, it should have actually occurred to me, why would ABC be at this conference? It was about a thought. I'm not even sure, a few hundred participants, but I thought to myself, why would a national ABC be here? I thought to myself, well, it's odd they've come here, but I had to wait 5-10 minutes for them to set up. So no one had a chance to tell me that they had been interviewing people and that they had this prior storyline in mind. And so when he starts asking me the question, he goes, well, why did you come here? And I don't remember the first question, but I think the first question was fine. And I said, well, I got invited to speak or something. And then he goes, but do you believe this? That this is that 9/11 is a conspiracy? And then he just launched in to, kind of extremely leading questions. And of course, I was then trying to quickly clarify why I had come and whatever. And certainly, I do not think, that 9/11, the full truth is out there about 9/11, because the 9/11 commission was hampered and right. restricted in a million ways. Nor do I think men in spacecraft or men in blue cheese came down and perpetrated 9/11.
Right.
I mean, there's this range of beliefs, and in a conference, any conference is going to include a spectrum. So if you want to make people look disparage the entire conference, you might pick out the people that are on the fringe or whatever to interview.
Right.
And of course, in this case, they were trying to connect the shooting at the Pentagon that had occurred the day before that had made, you know, obviously extremely sad, tragic, sensationalist news, a shooting at the Pentagon. And it turns out the young man was mentally ill. There were stories that said that his parents were extremely worried that he had become mentally ill and they didn't know where he was, etc. Had nothing to do with that conference. Nothing to do at all with that conference. And yet they were trying to connect the two things. And of course, once that became apparent, then I just tried my darndest to explain that. And I honestly sense at some point that Chris, he gets tasked to do these stories too.
Sure.
And I kind of sensed a teeny bit of shame on his end. I'm not sure. Maybe that's just my own thinking, but I kind of walked him out the door afterwards because after they did this real, kind of ambush interview of me, they were leaving quickly.
Yeah.
And so I walked out the door and I said, this is unbelievable. I kind of shamed him even worse. Like, we were not on the microphone, but I said, this is not right. This is not journalism to come in here with a story already and then to set this up. And I said, you should be ashamed of yourself. And I said, if you have any other questions about this, please feel free to call. Oh, no, I also said, please do not edit to this. Your story to make me look like I'm whatever. And I could kind of sense on their part that they didn't seem real comfortable with it at that point. But sure enough, they do a story and it was this very short piece. But because there were cameras rolling in other directions, the conference people had, you know, people there had cameras. And so they had the fuller interview to kind of counter it. But when you own the airwaves, you have to have that responsibility.
Yep.
And they don't have that anymore. The Cronkite, Edward Murrow type of responsible reporting. And if we went back, who's that?
I.F. Stone.
George
Seldes, I.F. Stone. Those great. Right. Those guys are great.
You know, this idea of journalism going for the truth and that you understanding that everybody's got biases and
sure.
And you can only do what you can do, but at least aiming for the truth. And that's just gone up in smoke now. Now it's just a free for all out there with your Fox and your Rupert Murdoch and your PR and your information management and it's who owns, now it's really who owns the airwaves, who has the power, who owns that microphone.
Yeah, we have people who assail us at the YouTube channel, blog, and a little bit on the Facebook where they like to say that, well, you have a bias. And, well yeah, I figured it was pretty well stated. Yes, we have a bias. We're telling you a point of view. We're not twisting evidence,
right.
Though.
You know,
we are revealing, our bias is clear by the evidence mm-hmm. we're producing, and
yep.
You can refute the evidence, but we try to go as source as possible.
Right.
You're not going to see us post something from Washington Post and say that's the authority. We're usually going to give you a PDF straight from the government docket if we can, you know.
Well, and again, everyone understands that you can only do what you can do. But,
sure.
You know, if you are paid, that's the other thing, advertising. You know, with the mm-hmm. Tobacco Insider, Jeffrey Wigand, we had Mike Wallace, who to this day says it's the blot on his entire career that he canned the Tobacco Insider story.
Right.
And the reason is they had the tobacco company as their advertiser, Brown and Williamson.
Right.
And so that is unfortunate. The case now is that these powerful advertisers are the ones that are controlling what gets aired and what doesn't get aired.
I think that's a big concern, but my bigger concern has been the tacit agreement when I watch, for instance, CNN. Yesterday had Robert Reich, or day before yesterday had Robert Reich on talking about putting BP in receivership, and the guest who was sitting in, a guy who I see in there sometimes, I don't know his name, but he was sitting in for Rick Sanchez, and he basically called it from the get-go, this controversial proposal, this... And every word he used was completely this overly weighted negative that Robert Reich is looking at him like, what are you talking about? I mean, we've done this to companies before.
Right.
And the guy seemed – and he did this all day long for 2 days where he'd bring on someone from like Greta Berlin from the Free Gaza movement. Well, thank you for – I mean, you're certainly loud in your opinion, but we're glad to have you here.
Right.
It's like, well –
Yep.
Why did I need you to do that for me?
Right.
I thought
right.
I turned Fox off. Give me my channel back.
Right. No, so. It's a way of marginalizing, even when you have the person on, marginalizing them as being goofy and whatever.
And doesn't that show CNN in that line? They're kind of in that
three-person
line, you know?
Yep.
And MSNBC might be the last one. And I'll tell you, I catch MSNBC doing it too, but CNN will toe the Fox line. If Fox drops a turd, CNN picks it up. Waves
right.
it around,
right.
and you can't make a distinction. So, well,
yeah,
Colleen,
we need to better media. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, this is one way we're going to try to do it: independent media.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate your insight. We hope you'll join us again.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye.
Next up, Jess Levin of Media Matters on BP contributions and Obama. I want to welcome Jess Levin from Media Matters. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Very good. We've been very busy with BP this week. So one of the things that has been running underneath the conversation, and frankly, I even kind of fell into this before I realized the de facto right wing was using it, but talk about the $71,000 in contributions to Obama and whether or not that influences his decisions. What has Media Matters done research on this, and what have you found?
Right. Well, this was a claim. Sarah Palin got a lot of attention for it, but actually it popped up a little bit before that. I think Politico was the first one to do this this big article, Obama Biggest Recipient of BP Cash. Which on its face is true. But what we did was we dug a little bit beneath the surface. So Obama received, he's received $71,000 in BP Link contributions, but most of that is, or I think pretty much all of that is coming from employees of BP and not himself. In his 2004 Senate campaign, he did receive $1,000 from BP's PAC, but 21 other Senate candidates received more than that. And I think the biggest thing that we pointed out was that, you know, Obama's raised more than $799 million for his campaigns. So the money that he's received from BP's PAC and employees accounts for less than 0.01% of his total campaign contributions. So when you look at those numbers, it's hard to argue that that amount of money is having an influence over his response.
And do we have a sense of how other companies contributed to other candidates, for instance, John McCain or Sarah Palin?
Right. Well, I looked into it a little bit, and you know, BP in the 2004 election cycle, 2006, 2008, 2010, they've given more money to House and Senate Republicans versus House and Senate Democrats. ExxonMobil, it's the same thing. And then Representative Don Young, now he was only mentioned in passing by that Politico article I told you about. He's taken $73,300 from BP during his time in Congress. Mm-hmm. But which is out of a total $14.9 million raised. So his percentage, while still not a staggering amount, is, you know, definitely higher than Obama's. So, I mean, there you go.
Also, are there rules related to PAC money versus individual contributions?
Well, PACs, I believe, can give more than individuals.
And again, the $71,000, would that also possibly come from franchises, or do you know? In other words, if a guy who worked as a basic mechanic for a BP tagged dealership or whatever, you know, storefront in,
right.
say, Louisiana, he checks off, I work for BP, and I'm giving my money to Obama. That's legitimate. That's what this is about.
I would assume that you know, based on just my knowledge of political contributions, if you write down BP as your employer, then that would count as a BP contribution.
Right. Now, what I recently learned was that through some local ties to the oil industry is that unions were encouraging people to vote for Obama based on some idea that he was a union-heavy guy. So in one case, it's a very, very well-known petrochemical company down here. I'll leave that alone because of the the particular tie I have with them, but their union told their employees to vote for Obama, and that wouldn't surprise me if that many people put the money in the coffers. Now let's look at this the second part, which is about the narrative of what caused this event or who's responsible. What's been percolating about that in the right-wing media?
Well, you know, we've heard a mix of different things. A lot of them, you know, are not looking favorably on Obama and his reaction. Obama's Katrina has been a big one. And I think most ridiculous is that, you know, right-wing media figures saying that he hasn't done anything, claiming that his visit to the Gulf this week was his first visit, which is, you know, completely ridiculous. He was there on May 2nd. So I think, you know, there's no one underlying theme other than blaming Obama for the spill and for his reaction to the spill.
And so have we heard more of these conspiracy theories we heard in the first couple of weeks where this might have been set up to blow up in order to promote an agenda? Has that kind of died off a little bit?
It's died off a little bit, but I can't remember who, but I think we've seen another one recently, so it hasn't completely gone away.
Okay. Yeah, that seemed a little bit far out whacked.
It is.
So what else has been happening with the BP coverage? Is there anything out there aside from those two main issues that you've seen that is worth noting?
A lot of what I've seen recently, just on my own viewing, not that Media Matters has done that much with, but a lot of people critiquing Obama's, you know, whether or not he's shown the appropriate level of anger.
Oh, yeah, the emotionalism. Thank you. That's the third one.
I feel like that's a big one right now, which I understand, you know, I understand the optics of, you know, people wanting Obama to get angry, to, you know, really shake his fist at BP. But I'm just sitting here wondering when we all became the anger police and who we are to judge, you know, what is and isn't an appropriate level of anger for the president to be showing publicly.
Very well said. I think that that's apropos. Someone, I wish I could tell you who it was, wrote an op-ed this week that said, "We got the president we asked for."
Exactly.
And I think that is true. If the people wanted someone who was calm and would listen to all sides, that's what they got. If they wanted a fist raiser, that's not what they were electing. And I think that's a good point.
Oh, yeah. I was watching Morning Joe this morning, and they were talking about, you know, how President Bush, you know, when in his reaction to 9/11, you know, he sort of, you know, just went with his gut and didn't really think things over, and that's what got him some praise, and that's what got him a lot of criticism later on.
Right.
And, you know, wasn't really the guy you would look to be calm under pressure. And I think you're absolutely right. We got what we voted for. We knew who Obama was to begin with, the whole no drama Obama thing. So for us to be all of a sudden looking to him to just shout angrily on television at BP is kind of ridiculous.
Right. Well, I voted for Ralph Nader, but I do know that the package that came with Obama was clearly that, and it's still, sustained whether I voted for him or not. But I'll leave this for you for next week because you might not have seen this much, but I caught this stand-in anchor for Rick Sanchez the other day, and I'll run the clip in the show, discussing receivership, putting a BP in receivership with Robert Reich. And the entire time, the anchor was making it controversial. He kept saying the controversial opinion of, and it seems that that's an area where, you know, as the litigation begins to go forth, minimizing the litigation or minimizing regulations, laughing at anyone who would dare say something like putting BP in receivership, which has been done with other companies, when they had certain debts that were possibly more than their value. And yet, you know, like I said, this CNN anchor just all on his own decided it was a controversial decision. So, you know, we'll take a look and see how that develops. If you see anything, we'd love to have your feedback on that in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything. I think I heard something about this interview that you mentioned, but I haven't seen anything, you know, in depth just yet.
And on that thought, as we close, one of the earlier guests in our show today, we were talking about how the media comes up with, like that example, and another example, same anchor in discussing the flotilla, leans against the free Gaza guest he has and kind of mocks her a little bit with his, you know, well, you know, you have some radical views and we're glad you can share them here. Do you see that, for instance, like I have watched a lot of CNN this week because of the BP because I found them more reliable than others, but they do buy into Fox News and written columns that are very right wing. And how do you, in your years of watching this kind of media circus, how do you see that lending agreement take place? Or how do you view that lending agreement happening?
You know, I think we do see a lot of that, you know, more so on Fox, and I guess, you know, I haven't noticed it on CNN, but I don't watch that much CNN.
What I mean is that Fox will lay down a meme, and then CNN has to pick it up.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah. What Fox likes to do best is shout and shout about a particular issue for a while, and then start to complain that the media isn't covering it enough.
Right.
You know, whether it be based in fact or fiction. So a good example of this was the Acorn tapes,
right,
which, you know, is sort of a very complicated issue, and, you know, everyone has their different opinion on whether or not it was worth covering and whether the media should have been covering it. But the point is that Fox covered it, and then they targeted media outlets who hadn't covered it yet. And this is just something that they like to do.
Right.
So it seems like CNN, you know, and other outlets will just buy into it that, you know, they should be covering it because Fox is telling them to cover it.
Right. Well, we thank you again for a great report this week, and look forward to hearing from you guys in the future. The website is mediamatters.org. You can also sign up for their daily listing. It fills my box every day with more information than I can possibly keep up with, but it's worthwhile and topical. So we thank you for joining us, Jess, and hope that you'll join us again in the future.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Jess. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Next up, a reading of letters by Rachel Corey and comments from Cindy Corey.